You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM.
As the floodwaters recede across the East Coast and people begin to rebuild in the wake of Superstorm Sandy, discussion has turned to climate change. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg pointed the finger at climate change this week. Bloomberg noted that climate change is an urgent problem that threatens our planet. But Joseph Nevins believes that we need to point a finger not at climate change simply. We need to focus on a global privileged class that bears a greater responsibility for ecological destruction. Joseph Nevins teaches geography at Vassar College. His books include Operation Gatekeeper and Beyond, The War on Illegals, and the Remaking of the U.S.-Mexican Boundary. He's joined us by phone from New York to discuss climate change. Hello, Joseph, and welcome to Red Eye.
Thank you very much, Sean. It's a pleasure to be with you.
New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg had some interesting comments about climate change. What do you make of his remarks?
Well, on the one hand, of course, it's refreshing to hear a major political figure in the United States even acknowledge that climate change is an issue and it has something to do with what human beings do vis-a-vis the atmosphere. So that's all well and good. The question is, what does that acknowledgement mean? What does it mean in terms of, you know, our practices as a city, as a country, as a world, as, you know, a differentiated group of people, you know, in a world of profound inequality? And at the top of that very unequal ladder are people like Michael Bloomberg, who's a, you know, a multi-billionaire. I think his wealth is estimated at about $25 billion. He owns 12 homes. At least he owns a private helicopter that he flies all around the city, and he also owns a private jet that he frequently pilots to one of his homes in Bermuda. So in many ways, in trying to think about sort of what brings about the type of warming of the atmosphere that, you know, turns a tropical storm into something like a raging hurricane that we saw very recently in the New York, New Jersey area, that was, you know, Sandy, it's the activities and ways of seeing and being of people like Michael Bloomberg. Obviously, this is linked to, you know, larger systems, but at the same time, we have to put a human face on that, and he's part of that.
When talking about climate change, Mayor Bloomberg commented that President Obama has taken steps to reduce our carbon consumption. Do you agree with those comments?
Well, in some ways, I mean, in some ways, what he's saying is true, and to the extent that, you know, under the Obama administration, for example, there was an executive order passed that obligates the federal government to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions by 28% by the year 2020. And at the same time, earlier this year in August, I believe, the Obama administration passed a rule that will raise the average fuel economy of cars up to about 54 or 55 miles per gallon by the year 2025. So that's all well and good. What, again, these are sort of long-term things, and what that's going to actually mean in, you know, 10, 15 years is an open question. So, for example, around increasing fuel efficiency, you know, when we think about energy use, there's something called the Jevons paradox, right? Jevons with a J. And what Jevons noted is that often when people achieve greater levels of efficiency, right, vis-a-vis a particular practice or technology, that becomes a reason for them to use that particular tool even more. So it often will lead to actual greater levels of energy use. So, you know, so if you own a Prius, for example, which is relatively fuel efficient vis-a-vis, say, a Hummer, right, what you find is that a lot of people who own Priuses tend to drive more than they used to because they think they have a right to, because, you know, because of the savings their average mile per gallon, the average mile, you know, more efficient fuel standards that they have. So, you know, in some ways what Obama and a lot of people are doing is they're sort of focusing on relatively minor details. And given what climate science and climate scientists are telling us, that we need to radically reduce our ecological footprint, right, by about, you know, in places like the United States, over 90%, what they're saying, in a cut in greenhouse gas emissions vis-a-vis what we were emitting in 1990, right, within the next few decades, we need to really think in a really fundamental and radical way. And certainly the Obama administration and the upper echelon of the Republican Party, certainly, and the Democratic Party as well, are not thinking anywhere near those terms.
Let's talk about resource consumption. Who is consuming the bulk of the world's resources, and how much are they consuming?
Well, it's hardly surprising that the people that are most responsible for resource consumption, when we talk about resource consumption, we're talking about what individuals consume, but also the institutions that that enable such consumption are also consuming. So, for example, the U.S. military, right, is the world's biggest institutional producer of greenhouse gases, right? By itself, I think the U.S. military is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than Portugal, for example, the whole country of Portugal. So it's the upper echelons of the global socioeconomic ladder, and so it's most of the folks in places like Canada, the United States, Western Europe, United Arab Emirates, Japan, and then, urban elites in places like China, India, Russia, and South Africa, right? But for the most part, it's the so-called West, the countries that have long dominated the world economy, and in doing so brought, lots of misery to other parts of the world through war and invasion, colonization, and now increasingly because of their rapacious resource consumption, which has, profound life and death implications for people across the planet, especially the most vulnerable.
Have any of these scientists who've broached the issue researched the issue of climate change, have any of them made this connection between climate change and consumption in the wealthiest countries?
I don't want to say no, because I'm certainly not familiar with all the literature, but I don't know of anyone, really. I mean, at least in terms of major scientists. And, there was this, around the time of Rio 2, right, the so-called Earth Summit that took place in June in Rio de Janeiro, there was a very, a much talked about article that appeared in the academic journal Nature, which is one of probably the most prestigious academic journals in terms of science in the English-speaking world. And it was an article authored by 22 very prominent scientists from the United States, Finland, Canada, Chile, Spain. And what this article said was that the world is in very, very big trouble, right? And what it they said that the world is quite possibly approaching what the authors called a critical transition. And I'm quoting now from the article. It says, this critical transition is one, quote, with the potential to transform Earth rapidly and irreversibly into a state unknown in human experience. And so what they were talking about were, the rise in greenhouse gases, deforestation, melting glaciers, large so-called dead zones, in the oceans, brought about by pollutants, related to industrial agriculture, for example. That's what we find in the Gulf below Mississippi, New Orleans, and then they talked about what they said, what they called the drivers of this planetary scale critical transition, and the primary driver that they highlighted was population growth, right? Not consumption. And so when we talk about population growth, if we all close our eyes and, we say overpopulation, population growth, who is it, where are they, that appears in our minds? And it's those areas where there is high levels of fertility, in other words, where women are having large amounts of children. And those tend to be very low-income countries in the so-called global south, right, in places like Africa and Southeast Asia and Haiti, et cetera, right? In, the most affluent countries of the world, places like, the United States and Canada and Belgium, what we tend to find is very low population growth rates and in some cases negative population growth rates. Now, by focusing on population growth, what these authors are doing, whether they intended to or not, is effectively pointing the finger at the poorest places in the world, the ones that are least responsible, right, for resource consumption. So it's, again, it's about 20% of the world's population. Right. But one-fifth of the world's population is responsible for 80% of the globe's greenhouse gas emissions. And if you look at that historically, right, that one-fifth, that 20%, is responsible for even a greater share. So to focus on population growth really gets us nowhere. I mean, as the International Development Specialist David Satterthwaite, who teaches in London, has written about extensively. You know, if all of Africa were tomorrow to stop having children, right, that would have basically zero impact on global greenhouse gas emissions. Because, you know, and this should be an obvious point, because folks there, for the most part, consume very little.
So the problem begins really at home with us consuming the way and in the manner that we do.
That's right. I mean, you know, so about 2-3% of the world's population, for example, flies internationally every year. About 5-6% of the world's population gets on a plane and flies anywhere every year. Okay, one flight from, say, New York to Los Angeles, round trip, in terms of effective emissions, what its impact is on the global climate, is about 2 metric tons. That's about roughly equal to what an average Brazilian is responsible for an entire year in terms of greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, if you're a middle class or above in the United States, flying is sort of a rite of passage. It's like blowing your nose. It's not a big deal, right, in terms of, you know, being able to do it, you know, financially and logistically. But its impact on the climate is enormous, right? So this is sort of the beauty and the ugliness, depending on how you look at it, of, you know, our increasingly individuated society, right? Individuals reap the benefits, right? I can get on a plane and fly quickly to Los Angeles and hang out with my friends and then come back. But the costs, ecologically, are socialized, right? We all bear it. And because we live in an unequal world, right, those who bear the costs in an effective way most significantly are those who are most vulnerable, right? So those of us who are relatively privileged can shield ourselves in various ways. You know, there's been some really interesting discussions and analyses on this in New York City. There's a journalist, I think his name is David Rode. He wrote an article for The New Yorker. I think it was The Atlantic Monthly, within the last week. And he lives in southern Manhattan, a place, area called Battery Park. And when the storm was about to hit, he and his family went to a hotel in New York City. And hotels in New York City, you know, I mean, an inexpensive hotel will run you $250 a night. Right. So anyway, they move into the hotel, and because they knew their area was going to be flooded, and he notices that there are lots of workers there, and he asks them, "Well, why aren't you at home taking care of your family?" He said, "Well, we have to work, right?" And so because they're compelled to work, and they're relatively low paid, they're not in a position to move their families into hotels or do what they need to do to respond to the storm. So not surprisingly, the people that are suffering most are those who are low income. So in this sense, you know, these so-called natural disasters, in terms of their social impacts, they flow from and help to reproduce, you know, vulnerabilities produced along axes of race and class, gender, citizenship, etc.
Well, let's stick with economics for a moment. One of the reasons politicians seem reluctant to deal with climate change in any meaningful way is economic factors. There's been a lot of talk about unemployment, for example, in the recent presidential campaign. How do you see that problem?
Well, you know, when we talk about making radical change in order to produce a more sustainable world, it's going to lead to disruption. And so one of the challenges in making that transition is to build new mechanisms then they're going to provide for new forms of social security, right? New forms of community, so that we can support and help each other as we make that transition. Right? So it entails loss, it entails challenges, but at the same time, in building that, you know, making that transition, it provides great opportunities for us to not only to reimagine a new world, but to build it, and to provide long-term security that's far more effective than what we have today. So, you know, the United States, like so many other countries, I imagine the dialogue is similar in Canada. You know, we're addicted to endless growth, right? To call into question economic growth is, you know, put yourself on the, you know, on the political margins, right? Outside of what constitutes reasonable discussion in polite circles. Right? Clearly, this is not sustainable, right? In any sort of way, but it's rarely called into question. Now, what does it produce? Well, here in the United States, we've been measuring poverty levels for about 53 years in terms of the U.S. Census. And what the U.S. Census most recently revealed is that we're at the highest level of poverty since they began taking those statistics. Right? So we've had, you know, we're always growing, with rare exception in the United States in terms of the national economy. But a greater slice of the population lives in poverty. Right? So it's clearly, you would think if growth were the answer to insecurity, that we'd almost be done with poverty in the United States, to say nothing about the rest of the world. But clearly, it's a lot of other things that are going on that produce poverty and insecurity, and that's how we allocate our resources. And increasingly, those resources, you know, in terms of socioeconomic ones, which are related to ecological ones, are allocated unequally, nationally and globally. And that's what we have to really address. It's not so much an issue of growth, it's how we organize and allocate what we have.
Well, how do we go about transforming this social system then?
What, do we have about 6 hours left? Well, you know, I mean, this is always the challenge when we're talking about radical change, right? When we, you know, whether we're talking about fighting, you know, slavery, fighting empire, fighting, you know, Jim Crow in the U.S. South or whatever, the first thing we have to have is a vision. Right? We have to have a vision, you know, we have to have a critical analysis of what the problem is, and we have to have a vision of something better. And there's a, you know, very famous book written by Miles Horton and Paulo Freire. Miles Horton was one of the founders of the Highlander Center, which still exists. It's a great center of thinking and analysis and training for political organizers and strategists in Tennessee. And people like Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King, you know, spent a lot of time there. In any case, the title of the book is You Make the Road by Walking It. You make the road by walking it. Anytime we're talking about, you know, taking on big systems like apartheid or something like that, it's an inherently messy process. But it's the vision that you know, fundamentally different vision that helps to discipline us as we struggle to try to reach that ultimate goal. So how do we get there? Well, you have to have a vision and a willingness to get there, and we can only say how to get there after we've done it. We make the road by walking it. If I'm making sense.
Well, no, I think that's a great metaphor, Joseph. And thanks so much for talking with us today and indicating us a new road that maybe we can take.
Well, thank you, Sean. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
I've been speaking with Joseph Nevins. He teaches geography at Vassar College. His books include Operation Gatekeeper and Beyond, The War on Illegals, and The Remaking of the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. You can read his article on climate change at dissidentvoice.org.